loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Hillary Clinton will not face charges, despite the fact that the FBI director says other people who did what she did should face consequences. We are going to talk about the politics behind the non-indictment. China has kicked off military drills in the South China Sea the week before a court in The Hague is expected to rule on the territorial dispute between China and the Philippines. China's week-long drill started as a Chinese state newspaper warned against U.S. intervention in the strongest terms. Impeachment proceedings are going forward in Brazil despite the Senate's own report. That's the Brazilian Senate's own report, clearing President Dilma Rousseff of the main charge against her. But first, we turn to the FBI's announcement that Hillary Clinton will not face charges over her email scandal. We are joined by Ray McGovern. He is a former CIA analyst and political activist and journalist. And by Mara Verheiden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Welcome back, Ray and Mara.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Mara, let's start with you. FBI Director Comey said yesterday that, quote, although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. First of all, Mara, what does it mean as a lawyer, and you are an attorney, a constitutional rights attorney here in Washington, D.C., what does it mean when a top official is, let's see, extremely careless in their handling of sensitive, highly classified information? I mean, is that illegal?
Well, the issue here is what were the potential charges, the statutes that Secretary Clinton may have violated? And the one that most people were looking at, of course, is the Espionage Act, which says that you are guilty of violating that act if, in fact, you have committed what's called gross negligence in terms of the handling of classified and sensitive information. And here you have the director of the FBI saying that what she did and what others did was extremely careless, which most people recognize as being the definition of gross negligence.
Right. So, and Mara, before I turn it over to Ray, I mean, let's talk about the timing of this announcement. It was quite extraordinary. I mean, it happened today, right the day after July 4th and right before President Obama began campaigning with Hillary Clinton.
Well, it's a remarkable week of events. You have a week ago Monday with Bill Clinton inadvertently, accidentally running into Loretta Lynch and visiting her airplane in Phoenix. And then by Friday, Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, announcing that while she won't recuse herself from the case, she will now accept whatever recommendation is given to her by the FBI. Saturday morning, Secretary Clinton sits for what her office was calling a voluntary interview with the FBI on this issue for 3 hours. And then yesterday morning, the first business day after that interview, before noon, we have Comey coming out and announcing that he does not believe that she has broken any law. It is extraordinarily fast. It is highly unusual. And it is remarkable to see that the Justice Department could so carefully evaluate her interview, analyze it against the other interviews that they've done, look at her statements in the other interviews against all of the evidence of this investigation for these years, and before noon, on the first business day, Tuesday morning, announce that it's all fine.
Ray McGovern, you are not only a former CIA analyst and a well-known journalist and author yourself, you are also part of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. You've been doing a lot of work on this issue in particular. Were you surprised about Comey's announcement?
Sadly, I was not surprised.
How come?
Well, we have this today, a fellow who is a fraudulent lawyer. That should be an oxymoron, but it isn't. Obama pretends to be a constitutional lawyer, and right and left, he violates the law by not executing his function as enforcer of the law, no matter what people do, torture, kidnapping, black prisons, and by arrogating to himself the right, as he sees it, to be prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, to include American citizens if he's told that they might be suspected terrorists. So, you know, the general context of how Obama has abused the law, this is small potatoes, but it's very, very serious if you're an intelligence professional. Because as we look at it, this email server was the equivalent of having a mole in the office of the Secretary of State, except the mole would only hear one side of a conversation. Anyone who could hack into these emails would hear both sides. And when Bobby Gates, former defense secretary, says, you know, it's a safe bet, the Russians, the Iranians, everybody who has a rudimentary hacking capability has all this, what does it mean? Well, one thing it means is they've got leverage over the president, the person who may become the next president. You know, it's the kind of blackmail potential that J. Edgar Hoover would salivate over, and they have it. We know they have it, because if a taxi driver from Romania can hack into that same server and come up with Bill Clinton's doodles as he got bored at meetings in the White House, doodles not available in the Clinton library, mind you, doodles protected, not protected, that is, by a server such as Hillary used. You know, this is really, really essentially important, not only because there was top secret information on that, but there was code word information and information that bears the moniker special access programs. That means even if you have a TS or a top secret clearance, even if you're cleared for code word, you're not cleared for special access programs unless you're actually involved in running the programs. I'm talking about covert action. I'm talking about drone strikes and all those kind of things. So, she's guilty of sin. The lawyers are playing games with, you know, whether it's the fraudulent lawyers you accepted, Mara, are playing games with, you know, the difference between extremely reckless and grossly negligent. Well, you know, what she did was gross negligence. And when it comes to intent, I talked with John Kiriakou, who spent 23 months in a federal prison. And he told me that Judge Brinkema of the hanging court in Alexandria told him specifically and his lawyers, intent does not matter in these cases. It doesn't matter whether you intended to do this or not. Well, Comey is carving out a new variation on the Espionage Act, saying, well, you have to take everything into consideration. And this is precisely what he says here. I've got the thing. He says, you know, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. There are obvious considerations like intent and how similar situations have been handled in the past. Well, talk to John Kiriakou about that.
Yeah, John Kiriakou, who was... Go ahead, Mara, jump in.
Well, I want to jump in on that point because I think there's a critical phrase here in James Comey's statement that that people need to be aware of, which is he goes through, he indicates that there's some evidence, but in the end he's saying, as Ray is talking about, that a prosecutor wouldn't bring this case. And the reason that he points to, among the reasons he points to, is the phrase he uses is that there were no indications of disloyalty, unquote, to the United States. So, it's very interesting. That's not written into anything anywhere, but that's an open definitional statement that basically means if you were a whistleblower and the U.S. government then determined that that's disloyal to tell the truth to the American people about what the government is doing when the government tries to hide it, then you're getting prosecuted, like John Kiriakou, like Chelsea Manning. But if you are doing the same acts, like Secretary Clinton, and James Comey decides that there are not, quote-unquote, indications of disloyalty, and then if you're violating the statute in word, it doesn't matter.
Right. And I want to go back to Comey's statement. He says, to be clear, this is not to suggest that in similar circumstances, a person who engaged in this activity, we're talking about Hillary Clinton taking all of this classified sensitive material and putting it on a private email server and making it very vulnerable and also not FOIA-able, not available for Freedom of Information Act requests because it's on her personal server when it should be on the State Department server. He says, to the contrary, those individuals who are often subject to security or administrative sanctions, in other words, that's what should be happening even if this person didn't commit a crime. So there should be consequences, Ray McGovern. That's what Comey says. But of course, Hillary Clinton's out on the campaign trail a couple hours later with President Obama. He's saying she's going to be the greatest president ever. I mean, since him, what are the consequences or what should they be?
Well, the consequences for me, well, let me put it this way. I see Obama, Comey, Holder as a disgrace. The profession that my father, as a law professor, devoted his life to. I'm just glad that he died before he saw what's happened to the law profession. And when I see this kind of thing continuing, you know, when I see, for example, that someone can clip off the classifications of a document and send it by insecure fax, when I see literally emails that say, I don't want to make this available outside of my own privacy here because I don't want anybody to read my personal email, it's very clear that Hillary Clinton is keeping her correspondence out of what the law provides, that is the Freedom of Information Act requirements. So she's in total violation of the law. And, you know, the other precedent here is Petraeus, who lied to the FBI. You know, one thing a citizen knows is that you don't lie to the FBI because that's ipso facto a felony. Well, you know what? For Petraeus, they made that a misdemeanor. They gave him a fine of $100,000, which is two-thirds of what he makes for an hour-long speech. And they gave him a slap on the wrist. You know, there are two laws here, and John Kiriakou has it exactly right. One law for those privileged in the 1%, one law for the rest of us.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, the FBI, as Comey stated yesterday, went through several thousand work-related emails, tens of thousands of emails. They went through fragments of emails. They went through emails that they couldn't find on her server, emails that she had deleted, emails that they were able to track down by going through the emails of other State Department employees or other U.S. government employees in the Obama administration. In other words, he's talking about a painstaking effort to come up with what actually happened with Hillary Clinton's decision to take her State Department emails and put them on an email server. I mean, all of this is at taxpayers' expense.
Right. And by taking that material, which is material done on the public's time that the public is entitled to, that as many people have speculated, by taking it out of government server was making it not amenable to Freedom of Information Act requests. And the fact that then she was actually using multiple servers, people refer to one, but Comey also makes the point that there are multiple servers are being commissioned, decommissioned. And they say that he says that it took thousands of hours to piece this together. I mean, the very fact that the taxpayers had to pay for minimally the thousands of hours to reclaim and piece together emails that should be available to the public and information in the historical record to which the public is entitled. I mean, minimally, you think that she would be required to pay for that, given that she caused this to happen and it was an intentional decision to remove this material and not and to maintain it in this way. And, you know, there's one point I want to make, too, that I think is important in here. In her interview on Saturday, after the fact, she and her spokespeople were again reiterating her statement that she's never received or sent material that was marked classified. The argument has been that anything that was classified after the fact. But Comey's statement says that there was material that was top secret, special access, marked as such when they were sent and received, including additionally material that was classified by intelligence community at the time it was sent and received. If she testified to that under oath, and he is saying something different, then that also raises additional issues.
Ray McGovern, Hillary Clinton is on the campaign trail. She wants to be the next president of the United States. I think she will be the next president. The entire military-industrial complex and Wall Street establishment seems to be the preferred choice. Perhaps they think Donald Trump is too much of a magnet for protest. He's too racist. He's too, you know, on his own, too much of a maverick. Or because he says the United States should not be part of NATO or should have a friendly relations with Russia. Whatever it is, the establishment is really against Trump. They're for Hillary Clinton. And you see now President Obama is out on the campaign trail. I mean, when you look at Hillary Clinton in a big picture, I mean, how do you characterize her? She was there for Bush when he carried out the invasion of Iraq. She was there for the war on Libya. WikiLeaks just released some emails, 1,258 Hillary Clinton emails this week that talk about her positions on the Iraq war, where she's sort of salivating over Iraq's oil resources. Talk about how you view Hillary Clinton at this point.
Iraq and Libya are clear indications of what kind of president she would be. The Iraq decision was no mistake. That was a calculated, cynical political move so that she could appear tough enough to be president next time around. Look what happened in Iraq just 2 days ago. 300 people killed by bombs. Now, look at Libya. You know, when Obama was asked if he had a mulligan, would he take a mulligan? You know, what mistake would he rather not do? And he said, well, Libya. We didn't plan for day two. Well, that's Hillary's job. And everyone knows that Hillary was the prime mover behind Libya. Libya is a shambles now. So it's not a question of experience. It's a question of judgment. And beside that, you have all these special entitlements that she believes that she's entitled to. It's kind of a sad story to see Obama throwing his full weight behind her.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined by Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst. He is with the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS. He is also, you can read his writings on raymcgovern.com. We're also been joined by Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She is the executive director of the legal organization Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. China has kicked off military drills in the South China Sea the week before a court in The Hague is expected to rule on the tinderbox territorial dispute with the Philippines. China's week-long drills began as a state newspaper warned against U.S. intervention. We are joined from New York by Don DeBar. He is the host of the morning show on CPR, Community Progressive Radio. Welcome, Don DeBar.
Thank you, Brian.
So launched a week of drills in the South China Sea yesterday. Will the U.S. government finally get the message that the Pacific is not their backyard? What do you think?
Well, first of all, they've been behaving as if it is. I don't know how, but 7 countries, 8 countries have various claims to various pieces of sand in various parts of the South China Sea, and the United States has been making mischief with that for a long time. Clearly, it's targeting, with its pivot to Asia, its rise. And you'll even hear people like Ashton Carter say, you know, China's rising. That's a good thing. And then start commenting on the fact that this actually has some independent course of action it would like to take from time to time and preserve its ability to do so. And he considers that a threat to the United States. So, you know, if you look at a map and you see how many U.S. naval bases there are, for example, around China, and then imagine one of those, say, on Block Island in in the East Coast or, you know, somewhere off the California coast, which it would be treated as a major threat. As a matter of fact, you know, the installation of a few missiles 90 miles away in Cuba back in 1962 almost resulted in the end of humanity. So,
right. China's Global Times newspaper ran an editorial yesterday that said that the U.S. military buildup constituted a direct threat to national security, meaning the national security of the People's Republic of China. I mean, at the same time, you had the Pacific Rim ago in which the Chinese were invited to participate along with the United States in a U.S.-led military operation, war exercises in the Pacific. It's kind of an ambivalent message. Is there growing sort of new China, or are both sides shadow boxing? How do you see it?
Well, at the same time, practically, it was last week, you had this joint drill going on, RIMPAC. You also had the presidents of Russia and China announcing individually the fact that they have come to the conclusion that they have a strategic alliance. There's a strategic alliance of interest, and consequently, they acknowledged that they had a strategic alliance. So, ambiguities across the board, contradictions across the board, but the the way the U.S. is pointed forward-based surrounding Russia and China from the from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, it's unmistakable which way. I think that China is well aware of the fact that it has this huge military, this huge military cash aimed at it, and it's at least as entitled to say this is an existential threat or a threat to our national security as the U.S. is a national security, as President Obama did twice in the last year or so.
Don DeBar, I want to also go back to the same editorial. It's China's Global Times newspaper. The editorial said, China is a peace-loving country and deals with foreign relations with discretion, but it won't flinch if the U.S. and its small clique keeps encroaching on its interests and its doorstep, meaning China. Now, let's talk about U.S.-China relations sort of in the big picture, because for a long, certainly since the death of Mao Zedong, and maybe even before the death of Mao in the last few years when the United States sort of wooed China and developed what appeared to be an anti-Soviet alliance in the early to mid-1970s. But then after Mao's death, there was the Deng Xiaoping leadership and a general realignment of China's foreign policy that would be more or less, an appeasement policy, recognizing that the U.S. was the dominant power in the Middle East, in other parts of the world, certainly in Latin America. The Chinese did not confront the United States, as they had done, say, in the 1960s, the very radical 1960s or the 1950s, when China was in a military alliance and a political alliance with the Soviet Union. But now you have, after the Asia pivot, more of the kind of language that's reflected in this editorial. China is a peace-loving country, but it won't. And its small clique keeps encroaching on its interests, on its doorsteps. In other words, China sees that the United States, even though China may have appeased the United States' foreign policy, the United States isn't sort of saying, thank you very much, we're going to leave you alone now. They're coming into China's backyard, into the Pacific, in a big way with the Asia pivot. So is it like there's no appeasing the U.S.? I mean, do you think it's possible that China's foreign policy will or has already sort of been realigned as a consequence of these facts?
Well, China's foreign policy would, mature as its economic power had grown almost geometrically over the last 30 years. Its ability, despite rhetorical flourishes and perhaps even an ideological affinity with the liberation movements that were taking place in the 1960s, its ability to project military power, even soft power, because it was a relatively minor global economic player at that time, was minimal. That's an entirely different environment now. It is, by some measures, the largest national economy in the world. Others is second behind the United States. Certainly in terms of its ability to produce manufactured goods, it is the largest economy on the face of the earth. So it has a nice deck of cards to play globally. It is very conservative in the way that it plays. China is not a forward-based, aggressive power like the United States. It is deferential, some say to a fault, on the global stage generally. To the, sovereignty of other countries, something the United States has a great deal of difficulty handling on its own, in its own interactions. And also, will step aside somewhat to accommodate others to avoid a confrontation. Now, we've seen that change somewhat at the United Nations, for example, Syria, that in the period between the resolutions on Libya and the resolutions on Syria, a couple of months, I think, if memory serves, 2011, with Russia and China both asserting in the latter part, that was an interesting wake-up call at the Security Council, because you had Russia and China standing up and together to impede a military action that the United States wanted very much. Into all of that, you know, the nature of China's economy as opposed to the nature of the U.S. and EU economy, particularly the U.S., tells you something about the type of power that they will be, you know, they're in the process of assembling over time. You know, the factories are in China, not in the United States. And should there come a protracted period of, say, medium-level conflict, you know, on a large scale between the two, you know, the United States could drop lawyers on Chinese cities and over time while China get they need. So in actual growth in the long term or even medium term period has the ability to isolate or insulate itself from the vagaries of the global economy because it has a great deal of development home and 1.6 billion people both to apply to the task and also to help consume excess you know, products. The United States like that, and the nature of its economy is such as a wage capitalist imperialist power. It's really something that has been eating its own base for a very long time, and it isn't really a competitor. If you look at China and the U.S. in Africa, China and the U.S. in Latin America, at the end of the day, the United States offers people another looting session, and China offers them development. In terms of geopolitics, the leadership of the United States has to see their days are numbered if they don't take some sort of an affirmative step to stop that from further maturing. And a lot of this, I think, is aimed at that.
We're talking with Don DeBar. He is the host of the morning show on CPR, Community Progressive Radio. Don is a longtime political analyst, anti-war activist. He was involved, for instance, in the struggle to stop the NATO bombing of Libya, of course, conducted by the U.S. government and France and Britain. Obama said we're leading behind, but of course, at the end of the day, Hillary Clinton was there saying we came, we saw, he died, meaning Gaddafi was lynched. Don DeBar was part of that anti-war movement, and we're talking about military tensions far away from the Middle East, where people now sort of almost routinely expect states to be involved in military conflict. We're China. We're talking about the Pacific. We're talking about the Asia-Pacific, and to be at sometimes shield escalations of their own sort of confrontational positions. We have, as I was quoting earlier, the China Globe saying, China is just sick and tired of the United States sending its aircraft, its air force into the region, asserting power. In other words, building a lot of countries like the Philippines, perhaps, like Vietnam, like other Asian powers, as part of a contained China strategy. And China is moving now, even though they had a soft foreign policy, a conservative foreign policy, perhaps an appeasement foreign policy, the U.S. can't afford to do that in their own backyard. Don DeBar, let's talk about Vietnam, because, of course, Obama was in Vietnam. He was the first U.S. president to go there. He lifted the arms embargo on Vietnam. And Vietnam obviously has both friendly relations with China, but also conflicts with China, as it does with the United States. And Vietnam has condemned these latest Chinese war games. Talk about how...
You know, there's contradictions across that region. You mentioned the Philippines, and you have Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Myanmar, and Vietnam. In the region, China is regional power. That's historically been true. And so it's natural, on the one hand, for you know, the smaller players in a region to look for an external sponsor, partner, balance the power of the local big power. The United States has been wet to death. You know, to me, it's an interesting, almost unbelievable contradiction. Given, you know, when I was growing up, block of my youth and early adulthood, the United States was bombing the hell out of Vietnam from like 1965 to 1974. 500,000 troops in and out, millions of Vietnamese killed. You know, that's not so long ago historically, but there have been you know, military conflicts between China and Vietnam that popped up from time to time, and so, you know, clever move on the part of the United States would be to try to exploit that, and that, in fact, is what they have apparently done. Now, again, I mentioned contradictions there. We've seen India, which conducted some naval maneuvers with the United States in the western part of the South China Sea and, you know, to the western end of this whole containment zone that the United States seems to be in the process of setting up. And also, though, India very close to Russia in particular, having conflicts on and off with China. But inside the BRICS and the SCO and all these other groupings that are developing in terms of economic relationships, you know, they're getting closer, too. But and China itself being involved in RIMPAC, military maneuvers with the United States. I think that long term, anyone who's really paying attention in these countries, even South Korea, sees that their future has China very definitely involved. And in fact, China has been playing that two-edged sword as well.
Don DeBar, let me ask you, we have about 2 minutes left. I want to switch over now to the Philippines. Next week, The Hague will make a ruling, a verdict about the through the Permanent Court of Arbitration about the claims made by the Philippines against China in the South Island, South Sea disputes over different territories that are claimed by both countries or many countries. Now the Philippines' new president said in Manila that he and the Philippines are ready to talk to China, and they are not going to war. If an arbitration tribunal rules in its favor, meaning in the favor of the Philippines that brought the case with a previous Filipino administration, that'll be fine. He says that's good, but he says at the end, it's favorable for us to talk. We are not prepared to go to war. War is a dirty word. Is there a change, a new orientation in the Philippines that may be not to the liking of the United States in terms of Philippine-China relations?
Yeah, it's possible. You know, the new government, of course, has to find its feet politically, and it has to take an assessment of, you know, what the public sentiment is there. Certainly, no one in their right mind in the Philippines or anywhere else in the region wants a war with China. And yet, you know, one could occur because almost everyone that goes to war says that they don't want war until they're deeply involved in it. Nevertheless, it does seem, at least, you know, in terms of the surface of the political game in the Philippines, that there has been a change in direction, and hopefully that is going to mean, you know, something expressed in policy, that if the United States is hell-bent on driving towards a war with China or a near war with China and a heightened military state with China, that the Philippines may not be a reliable partner, which may make the U.S. consider the foundation of that policy.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We have been talking with Don DeBar. He is the host of the morning show on CPR Community Progressive Radio. Thanks so much, Don. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Impeachment proceedings are going forward in Brazil, despite the Senate, the Brazilian Senate's own report, clearing President Dilma Rousseff of the main charge against her. Brazil's Senate is questioning Rousseff's representative as the coup government's legitimacy continues to erode. We are joined from New York by Kim Ives. He is the contributing editor of Haiti Liberté. Welcome back, Kim.
Thank you, Brian. Glad to be here.
So bombshell findings were released by the group of independent auditors hired to report to the Senate. What did the report find? How did it undermine the pretext for this legal coup against Dilma Rousseff?
Well, the core of the accusation against her was that she was involved in what they call fiscal peddling, which is sort of a wheeling, dealing, illegally delaying repayments to state banks and so forth. And essentially, they find that did not happen. And so the accusations, the charges against her are essentially obliterated. And so I think this is a case where the principal pillar of their attack against her has been removed by this committee. But now they are trying to say, well, that wasn't really what we were looking for. That's not the main thing. It was another case of where she had done certain credits without congressional approval, and they're trying to put the emphasis there. Again, this gets into a lot of minutia, which will make people glaze over, but essentially her defense says, well, even that doesn't stand up because the fiscal year didn't end, and so that can't be applied. So in any case, the reasons, the principal reason that she was impeached has now been removed by this finding.
But okay, so just help the audience understand then. So if that's the case, will the impeachment trial go forward? I mean, in other words, is there a way back to the presidency for Dilma Rousseff?
Well, there is, because now the findings will go to the Senate and they will make a vote which will say yes or no, should it go forward. If they say no, then she's okay, but and she resumes the presidency. But if they say yes, which is very possible, because this is clearly, and I think it's more and more clear even to the people of Brazil, that this is a purely politically motivated process, a purely politically motivated coup, and there's nothing in it that has any validity in terms of corruption, etc. In fact, the real corrupt element of the power structure is really the very people who are accusing Dilma of corruption, and this is the PMDB, or her former allies, supposedly, who are, as Greg Greenwald of The Intercept said, perhaps the most corrupt party in the hemisphere.
Right. So here we have very, very, very corrupt politicians impeaching Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party for corruption. But the corruption isn't really of a personal character. It's corruption, they say, of what you described as peddling, meaning shifting funds from one agency to another to cover shortfalls or whatever. By the way, in the U.S. Congress and in the U.S. government, the U.S. government routinely took money from Social Security, which was, you know, designated money for people when they retire, money that they put in through their own taxes and the taxes paid by their employers. The U.S. government routinely uses Social Security to cover budget shortfalls, and then the money comes back. In other words, it's temporary. It's peddling. It's finagling. It's maybe legal, maybe not legal, but it's routinely done. And she's impeached, and now she's out of office, and Michel Temer, the right-wing sort of organizer, or one of them, the organizers of the coup, who also is under corruption scandals, he becomes the president. And so Dilma's trial could be any time in the next, whatever the time is now, 150 days. She has to wait for the trial unless the Senate overturns the impeachment proceedings altogether. Okay, that's what's happening at the top. That's what's happening in the Senate. That's what's happening among the politicians. But then you have, on the ground in Brazil, real people who have elected this government, the Workers' Party government, four consecutive times. They voted by 52% in 2014 for Dilma. They see that their vote is being essentially undone by these shenanigans in the Senate, which continue to, you know, unravel. I mean, will the people in Brazil find a way to rise up against the coup plotters, or is there so much political confusion that that's not likely right now in Brazil?
Well, I think it's a big question, because there were definitely huge millions of people in the street prior to the coup. Since then, things have sort of flipped and reversed. Now, Temer is facing a 70% disapproval rating, and Dilma has a higher approval rating than before the coup, before she was impeached. And you have seen some demonstrations around sort of culture issues and health policies and this sort of thing. But you haven't seen the same level of millions of people saying, put Dilma back. So it's a little unclear if victory can be snatched from the jaws of defeat at this time. And add to that the fact that the parliament is pretty much, now that the PMDB has flipped and turned its coat and gone over to the right wing, to a right wing alliance. Basically, you have about 2/3 of the Senate and 2/3 of the House, too, which are, we could say, anti-Dilma, anti-Lula, anti-Workers' Party, and conservative, and only 1/3, which is standing with Dilma and Lula. That includes the Brazilian Communist Party, the Socialist and Liberty Party, what they call PISO, and some elements of the PMDB. But so between the two, between the anemic response in the streets and but growing. We should always leave the door open there. And the way the parliament is stacked against them. Now, you know, we have to see what happens because this report really is a game changer. This may completely throw the people into the street and throw the weight. We have to say with the Olympics coming, of course, the pressure is building. So, you know, anything can happen.
Right. So the report said Dilma Rousseff, the report from the auditor said that Dilma Rousseff, the president of the Workers' Party, who was elected in 2014 with 52% of the vote, that she did not delay payments to state-run banks as charged. That would have violated Brazil's fiscal laws. There are other things that the auditors say that are without controversy, that Rousseff authored three 2015 decrees releasing additional credits without Congress's consent. I think these are credits to maintain social programs, in fact.
Yeah. And the point is those can be paid back, and that's what her defense does say. That is that it ends up being kind of an argument around a fiscal year, et cetera. Her defense arguing that this can only be considered a breach if it ended after the end of the fiscal year, which didn't happen in 2015. So this kind of arcane minutia is really what starts to be, the devil is in those details.
Kim Ives, when you were on our show on Loud and Clear last time, we talked about, and when we were talking about Brazil, we talked about the impact, the geopolitical impact, the global impact, and also the regional impact of having a right-wing government in Brazil. And you talked about Brazil's role in BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. The effort by these five strong major economies, still in the case of Brazil, for instance, or China, emerging economies, or India, or South Africa, emerging economies to create sort of a counter-hegemonic world force that would sort of be a counterforce to the United States domination over the IMF, the World Bank, NATO, you name it. But Brazil, of course, is a very big country. It's the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. With a right-wing government, could there be sort of a Brexit from BRICS? In other words, where Brazil actually pulls out of BRICS, and what would be the impact of that?
Well, it'd be a huge impact. It is the B in BRICS, and I think likelihood that Temer would pull out, and I think that is the goal of it. The likelihood is that Temer would try to pull out of BRICS and disable it. I definitely feel that, you know, even though we don't have all the data and proof at hand, but you certainly get the feeling and can develop the hunch that the U.S. is working feverishly behind the scenes to make this coup go forward. And I think the timing around the time of the Olympics in Brazil, again, this is, you know, we saw a similar thing when the Olympics were held in Russia. They worked overtime to try to sabotage those and, get people. I mean, this is get people to boycott it. This is the way they work. Working at Haiti.
Who is they in this case?
Oh, I say Washington and its allies. But to me, this is principally a Washington-authored maneuver. For instance, in Haiti in 2004, when they were having an effort to have the world spotlight come and focus on the 200th anniversary of Haiti, they organized successfully an international boycott of this. And the only country that went was South Africa, Thabo Mbeki. And so the BRICS have played an important role in resisting these boycotts, these sort of symbolic campaigns that are waged to isolate people and say, you know, we are the international committed community and they are not. So this is part of the battle. It's for the image, for the world's conception of whether, for instance, the Olympics are a success or not, because that will say whether Brazil is a success or not.
And it really looks like things have seriously unraveled with the Olympics. I mean, at least in the corporate-owned media here in the United States, the reports are that the country is not ready to host the Olympics. I mean, there's construction lags. There is routinely with Olympics, but like major problems. And there's this dysfunction where the government is, in essence, the Brazil's government is in essence paralyzed. So it could be like one of the biggest sort of public relations disasters for any country if all, you know, sort of falls apart in Brazil at the moment the Olympics are taking place.
Exactly, because the spotlight is there, and you know, a lot of people who wouldn't even look at the political or economic news will be maybe following sports and say, oh my gosh, you know, this is a disaster. I think, you know, it's not also to be underestimated the role of the Zika virus, whose, you know, origins, okay, viruses do emerge, and that may well be something that's been popped up, but the focus on this virus, which really affects a very minimal number of people and is likely to affect a very minimal number, has really been put in the headlines and screamed and created a lot of panic and froth around it. So
right, like right now, the idea is if you are a younger person, if you ever want to have children, don't get Zika, don't go, say, to Brazil. I mean, that's right. The message everywhere.
Yeah, and so every time there's an Olympic athlete or an Olympic eligible athlete who says, I'm not going to Brazil, you know, that's front page, that's top of the news. So to me, this is all part of a multi-pronged effort to really knock down this largest economy of South America, which has played this key role in the BRICS and to some extent cannot be faulted for collaboration with Washington. We, again, going back to Haiti, they've played a role as the lead agents in the MINUSTAH, the UN mission to stabilize Haiti. That was their bid to try to get a Security Council seat. So they also bring a lot of, how shall we say, independence to the BRICS, which they might otherwise say is just a Russia-Chinese concoction. But, you know, Brazil is there, India, and South Africa as well.
Kim Ives, we have 1 minute left. I want to ask you really quickly, because it is 1 minute, just talk about the, or maybe 90 seconds, what is the regional impact? Because we're talking about BRICS, that's the globe, that's the confrontation between Russia and China, mainly on the one hand in the United States, but then you have Latin America, Venezuela, Argentina, Paraguay, Honduras. In other words, all of the left governments or center-left governments have been in crisis and being moved by the problems of economic destabilization, political destabilization, coups of one type or another, and moving in the direction of the right, moving in the direction or back in the direction of the United States. I mean, how do you see it? What's Brazil's role in that? If Dilma can be restored, could it be like a shift in momentum in Latin America?
Well, that's just it. It's what the CIA used to call blowback. To me, they may have miscalculated on this, and by, in a sense, giving a, in Creole you say a piqui, by giving just a little prick and not having done it deep enough, the response is, to me, there's an anti-imperialist backlash happening both in Brazil and around the region. Everybody, I think, is seeing this. Okay, people saw it in Honduras. People may have seen a hand in Paraguay, but in Brazil, it is really, really clear, and especially with the report now, which shows that there's absolutely no basis for these corruption charges against Dilma. So I feel that in some ways they may end up strengthening the anti-imperialist movements of the region and in Brazil rather than weakening them.
Right. So we had the coup in 1964 in Brazil, a terrible bloody coup. The left was essentially extinguished at that time. You know, thousands of people in prison, many, many killed. This kind of coup is a little bit different. It's a political coup, a coup that's taking place in Congress. And as a consequence, people do have still the capacity to fight back. And it's very predictable, given the contradictions faced by the coup makers, that they will fight back. We've been talking with Kim Ives. He's a founder of Haiti Liberté in New York. We've been talking about Brazil, but we're going to end it there. We're going to be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.